welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And as you know, that debt is fraud. And do not hesitate. Start organizing, because I think collectively there's power in prayer. And I believe getting organized and starting to utilize, you know, a collective power of prayer would probably be more than apropos. As a matter of fact, the scriptures tell us that we need to do those things. And so, you know, the scriptures also say, you know, to not to pray publicly, but I think when it comes to the people seeking, or to, you know, to actually help me out here, because Tammy, I believe there's somewhere in the scripture that says, you know, be weary of people that are praying in public, something like that. And I'm paraphrasing, but it basically tells us that we should guard our intimate relationship and our intimate thoughts and words with our, you know, our right. Creator, to where, you know, be cautious of those people who are constantly praying to show you how good they can pray, that type of stuff.
Yes.
And so
I know what scripture you're referring to, but yeah, I don't remember where it's at.
Yeah. And, you know, so, but I honestly believe that we do need to unify our voices so that, you know, we can all take turns in basically asking for that common thing. You know, like if we've been suffering from a drought, that we all should be asked individually and in our group prayers to have, you know, a prayer circle, or when we come together as a flock or as a church or body, that we, you know, include those things that we all seek. So anyway, anywho, with all of that, we're still going through the Constitution, and welcome back, folks. We've got Tammy with us, of course.
Hello.
And so we're covering Article 5. We just wrapped up Article 4. And Article 5 is the amendment process. Now, there are two paths to the amendment process. And actually, I know as the county chair in the past year, I think it was 20, maybe it was this year, at the beginning of this year, I spoke to your county central committee regarding the problems with the Article 5 convention.
Mm-hmm.
And so just to be clear, as Article 5 was explained during the framing through the ratification debates, they identified this is the process to deal with defects of the Constitution. Now, what's a defect? A defect means that the federal government has a power that they're exploiting that maybe they shouldn't have. So we would need to amend the Constitution to take away that power, to take away that role, responsibility, something that's enumerated in the Constitution. We need to get rid of it because, like slavery, protecting slavery. And so that would be a defect. We'd need to make a change to the Constitution. The only intent is to change the Constitution. And so the Constitution can be amended by either Congress, by two-thirds of each House of Congress, or by a convention. So we're going to go through those two paths. But to be clear, the whole point of the amendment process by the framers was to deal with defects in the Constitution. Do we want to give them a power, or is there an actual apparent defect like slavery? Or do they have a role, responsibility, power, or property? Like we talked about this in our last time we were together, or actually it was two times ago, maybe. No, it was last time, when we talked about the Article 4, Section 3, admitting states into the Union. And we talked about, you know, that the federal government had property within the states, like these forts, these magazines or arsenals or what have you, so that they would have the ability to help defend these new states coming into the Union. Well, as all the threats died away, the need for those forts should have gone away as well. But in addition to the needs for getting rid of forts, as technology expanded our ability to be able to throw rounds further, artillery further, we needed to expand our training and capabilities of training, but we don't need to have training in every state, right? If we had to have training, you know, like every state needed to have training, i.e. Rhode Island. Let's look at Rhode Island. Rhode Island needs to have a bombing range for aircraft, for artillery, and all of that. If they had to house that, they couldn't do it. They would literally be lobbing and dropping bombs on every person in Rhode Island.
Right.
So, you know, the states collectively have the ability to do the actual training so that when the militia of, because every state's supposed to have a militia and they're supposed to be able to guard themselves. So here's the question. Why would we need to have aircraft to guard America other than the Navy? Because technically, the only time we would actually be engaged in any warfare on American soil is if we're being invaded.
Mm-hmm.
So if the Navy and the Marine Corps were doing their job, and technically they had done their job, the only place America has ever been attacked in its 200 plus years of existence has been Hawaii.
Yeah.
And so we had the need and we had the military installations to guard ourselves, but we've never had to bomb the people of Hawaii in training and keeping our skills up. Now, actually, I believe that out in the Pacific, we have, you know, bombing ranges where we drop nuclear bombs, right? So, okay. We have the need to prepare and train, but bottom line, the need for these military installations should really have gone down significantly in America. Significantly. And what do we have in America? We actually have Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps bases, when technically the type of bases we need to have are what I would consider Navy bases, because where the Navy needs to be able to do all of this training, the Army could easily come in and use the Marine bases, because the Navy would not have artillery, but the Marine Corps would, because the Marine Corps is the ground forces to be deployed to foreign land. So if we have to go to a foreign land and fight, we would have basically two different types of roles, just a light expeditionary role like the Marine Expeditionary Unit, or a long-term role like an Army and or a occupying force. And so that would all fall underneath the Marine Corps, not the Army. The Army, the job of the Army under the Constitution was literally to guard the motherland. That's it. The militia. And the militia existed. So you have the militia that's designed to basically protect the motherland. And then the Navy had this role of protecting us from external threats. So if we had to go to war, it would have been the Navy and the Marine Corps. Why did they maintain and prop up and build the Army to be this occupying force around the world? Now you have two services, the Navy and the Army, and you have opportunity to have more officers. The more officers they have, the more politicians you can create within the military ranks. And everybody loves their politicians, right? So you kind of can see how this was actually propagating opportunity for more officers to make more money and have more responsibility. So we can't have enough officers. So they created the Air Force. They actually took the two separate functions, the ground game and the air game of the Army, which should never have been expanded to the way it was anyway. But now they divided that to have even more officers in the Army and the Air Force. And not to be undone, we now convince Trump to go out and create the Space Force to have more officers. Oh, and then we actually promoted the Coast Guard, which should have been a part of the Navy, to actually just, okay, you're just going to guard the coastline. But that should have actually been a part of the Navy. Folks, if we actually looked, if we treated our military system like HP or a major corporation, there's some serious downsizing that needs to occur and consolidation of what really needs to be done, because we could do a far better job with a lot less money. A far better job. We don't need that many officers. And every officer that hears what I just said, I'm not making friends. And here's the other thing. Here's the other kicker. We don't need the two branches, or I should say the two sides of service. We don't need an enlisted and an officer. The reason the enlisted and officer ranks were created was because the enlisted were uneducated. They usually just, you know, signed with an X. The officers were the ones that actually had education. And every once in a while, we had officers that became officers that had no formal education. As a matter of fact, my grandfather went into the Air Force and became a pilot without formal education. All he had to do to become a pilot in the Air Force in the 1940s was to pass a test. So what he did was he went off and studied what he needed to study and got himself prepared, and he went and actually took the test and passed. Never went to college. Never even got a high school diploma.
Wow. I think that's all that you would need.
So the point is that the fact that we have two separate rank systems is archaic. Why do we have two separate rank systems? We kind of do in business. We've got management and then we have labor, right? Mm-hmm. But technically, we don't need that much management at all when we could actually just be the best corporations that function today are people that are promoted within the ranks. In other words, you have people doing, and then you promote. Well, we do that within both ranks, because we actually have management that is promoted through the enlisted ranks. We have management promoted through the. This actually proves that the redundancy of the two rank system is obsolete. You don't need to have officers and enlisted. They all should be of a single rank system, that they all come in as privates, and that they all learn what is necessary, and they receive the training on leadership and management. But having two separate ranks, you know, all that does is it bolsters up one rank as superior, and, you know, and then bolsters up a different rank in different ways. You know, because I know enlisted, they say, yeah, you know, only enlisted can get that piece of metal to actually go down a runway and go up into the air and fly and function. In other words, the enlisted are the people to do that. It takes an officer to get in it and ruin it. Because that officer can't fix it. That officer doesn't know what it takes to get up there. And so all the officer's done is they learn how to, you know, operate the thing and ruin it. Because if they crash it, then they've ruined it. So... The fact is that we've never really kept up. We've never maintained what was best for America as we moved our military forces. And it was all done really more for political purposes. And why not? Why not keep on growing the Army to the Air Force and all these other things? Because we got all this money. We now have this paradigm of take, 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 more, more, more. Because after the turn of the 19th century and after the 16th Amendment, where they thought they could just spend and spend and spend and buy our way into prosperity, why not do all of these things? It is a bad business model to do that. Just think, if we actually had the states doing the things that needed to be done and actually taking away the ability... Now, I'm really going on... I'm always warned, GR, don't make these types of comments on the show. But I'm here to tell you that we are fools thinking that we can have a competitive market, when it is something that is non-competitive. I'll give you a couple of markets. Energy can be a competitive market, like going out and digging and pulling oil or natural gas or extracting energy. You know, that can be competitive. But when it comes to burning electricity in your home or burning natural gas in your home, are you literally going to have 20 lines coming into your home to choose who you're going to be buying from today? Oh, it looks like their rates are better. Well, switch over to that one.
Yeah.
You know, it's when you go and buy gas for your car, you actually have a few choices. But do you really? Actually, you have the big conglomerate, and then you have some independents out there. So the choices of competition are going down more and more and more. And yeah. As a matter of fact, one of the things I've noticed is when it comes to energy for electricity charging and so forth for the stupid EVs, this bad model of energy consumption, I'm noticing that the states are doing this more and more. In Washington State, the largest charging station and the first charging station wholly owned by government was just what do you want to call that? Christened, or, you know, they just launched it and they just opened for operations. And I think it was like Mount Vernon or someplace like that in the state of Washington, where the city basically invested all this money, taxpayer money, to start selling electricity for all these people with, come on now, who are we fooling? It's like internet. It's like the phone lines. You know, we create these businesses create, and all of a sudden the demand goes to a point where we say, you know what? This should be fundamental for our society. This is where I get in trouble. Because if we can find it as an essential thing, is electricity essential for our homes? Absolutely. It is. Yeah. It induces productivity in that home, because now you can function 24/7 with lights. It doesn't make, the sun does not need to be up for you to be able to function and be productive and do things. So is every living person in your state better off having electricity? Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So then why is it that the states haven't created their own public utility and actually managed that? That's what they should have done. And they actually kind of did that after the federal government took all the tax dollars and said, we want everybody to have electricity, which was a noble thing. But what should have happened was this should have been a state issue, and the state should have kind of done this. And had the federal government not been printing and printing and printing, and the states had this ability to do this, then I honestly believe that we as the states, let me look at it this way. As the edges of the United States, where most of the money, where they have the larger budgets in the state, you know, are they better off being connected, or should they have this vast emptiness between them? Being connected is far better for the strategy of the union. I'm talking about the union, not the federal government.
Right.
So in other words, having a good flow of commerce from Washington to Florida, California to Maine, and having roadways, energy, and those types of things, the states actually should be, because it's in their best interest to develop the interior states so that they can actually function, you know, like they're in their own states. So when we really start looking at it, yeah, there's always this need to be, you know, better, or, you know, we only care about us, just us. We're selfish. But being a part of the union, there's no room for selfishness.
Right.
Right. How, tell me, what are the banner marriages? The banner marriages are where both parties get along, where there's this equality shared. Do you believe that the best marriage is when one actually has a heavy hand and dictates everything? You have a dictator and a peasant? Is that a good marriage?
Yeah, most definitely not.
So the point is that, you know, there's empirical data that drives us down making what is the best decisions. And if we're not looking and we're not using empirical data, we're allowing ourselves to be driven by emotions and stupidity. Because stupidity means that we're just going to ignore the facts and just continue doing what we're doing instead of. And so this is how we have abandoned enlightenment, because technically, when we start looking at the Constitution and we start recognizing that there are certain things that we could be doing as a union much better than the federal government, then we could actually start functioning and unleashing the political and the potential of the United States. Because the federal government shouldn't be doing it. Because when we give them the power, it's only proven that they've weaponized everything that they've got. They've weaponized education. They've weaponized energy. They've weaponized housing. They've weaponized labor. They have weaponized everything to actually attack us with.
That's
agriculture. Everything that they've done, this is why Milton Friedman, in his book, I highly recommend, folks, if you want to read a book that was easily and plainly done by a, because economists are pretty difficult-minded people. I mean, they're pretty complex. Milton Friedman, Free to Choose, is probably one of the easiest books to read because he really lays it out there. Free to Choose. And in that book, he basically makes this comment. He says, if the federal government had the charge of managing the Sahara Desert, they would run out of sand within 5 years. So, I mean, that's just basically showing how inefficient they apply everything that they do. And I'll even go one further, that they would weaponize it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, let's dive into Article 5. We got about 3 minutes left, but we can actually talk about the very first clause, which actually takes us all the way into, well, it's actually, let's, you just read and we'll stop at the legislatures of two-thirds. Go ahead.
Okay. The Congress, whenever two-thirds of both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution.
Right there.
Oh, okay.
Right there. So that's the first path. Congress, by two-thirds of each, deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution. Or, now with the next part. This is the next path. Or on the application.
Or on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states shall call a convention for proposing amendments.
Period.
Which in
right
either
there.
Case.
Okay, it's a period right there. So that's the second path. The second path is that two-thirds of the states can petition Congress for a constitutional convention for amending the Constitution. So you have the Congress being able to propose amendments, or the states say, we want to create an amendment because you're not willing to do it. So now we have two-thirds of the states to say, we got to have these amendments because we got a real problem. Because again, the Constitution and the amendment process is to fix deficiencies with the Constitution. So in other words, you got two-thirds of the states agreeing that the Constitution is the problem. We need to fix the Constitution. Okay?
Right.
Now, go ahead. Which in either case?
Which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the several states, or by conventions, and three-fourths thereof.
Stop right there. Okay, so in either case, so you got the congressional path, or you have the convention path of two-thirds. So in two-thirds, you can create a convention. So you don't need the rest of the states to get on board, but to actually make whatever comes out of the convention or whatever comes out of Congress, to for those amendments or those changes to become valid, it states right here that the byproduct out of each, Congress or a convention, will require three-fourths of the state legislatures or conventions, because they say when ratified by the legislatures of three-fourths of the states or by the convention of three-fourths thereof. So in other words, the threshold is it will require three-fourths of the states to amend the ratification by the convention of the amendments proposed by the convention or the amendments proposed by Congress. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it's really pretty simple. The Article 5 process is really pretty simple. But again, it is designed to fix deficiencies. Wow, we got this new thing called education, and boy, is this a powerful thing. We want to amend the Constitution to do this. I'll actually give you one that was very relevant of the time. When Congress came to James Madison, I got 10 seconds. I'm going to tell you the story of the Department of Transportation and the need for an amendment, at least in Madison's mind, the need for amending the Constitution to give the federal government the ability to create what we would call just the footings of what we have called, or what we call today, the Department of Transportation. So when I come back, I'm going to kind of give you this overview of the story of how that was being proposed and how Madison was begging Congress to create an amendment to do this. And so when we come back, I'll dive into the fact that there was a call and a cry by presidents to amend the Constitution. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so in 1816, Madison was getting ready. As a matter of fact, the election, the reality that Madison would no longer be serving the Union because he was not running. He chose not to run for a third term. And so the election for choosing the next president, or actually choosing the electors so that they could choose the president in 1816, reality had set in. So Congress came over and basically approached Madison and said, you know, you've done so much. You have been such a faithful servant. And you've, you know, you're the father of the Constitution. What can we do that could actually, you know, be a hallmark law, a hallmark legislation? What can we do to, you know, basically recognize you as this prominent feature of American politics and government? And Madison went into real theory mode. He didn't do that very often, but he went into real theory mode. So he gave them an answer that actually provided them guidance, but didn't tell them exactly what they needed to do. That's why I call it theory mode, because he basically identified, now that we finally have peace with Britain and we're recognizing, and they're recognizing this treaty, the Treaty of Ghent, that they're no longer impressing our soldiers, that we're moving forward. Now that we have galvanized peace in the world for America, the one thing that Adam Smith points out, because he's really was referring to Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations, where it stated, where he stated that if America had, because it's a single nation, or it's a cooperative of nations where they're working together, this idea of these states working in tandem to benefit and to lift themselves up, this paradigm that we were just talking about with public utilities. So this paradigm that Madison was presenting to them is, if the states would actually, you know, focus on improving its throughput of commerce, highways and waterways, so that we could move commerce more efficiently from the interior of the United States, or the hinterland, to the coasts, and then back out again. So in other words, getting things from the interior to the coast to ship across the seas, and everything coming across the seas and getting that commerce out as far to everybody, so that consumption and production can flow just effortlessly. Yeah. Thank you.
We know what you mean.
My tongue gets tied. You know, I apologize. So anyway, I can write it. Sometimes me saying it's difficult. But anyway, without any effort, we're able to just basically move all of this commerce back and forth. And so they went back over to the House and they created and crafted a bill called the Bonus Bill. And so when they crafted that, they came back and said, you know, actually they got this passed by both houses. They said, this is what Madison wants. This is what Madison told us. He hoodwinked us. This is what he wants. And so they crafted this bill that would give the federal government the ability to improve highways and waterways. It's called the Bonus Bill. And he received that bill. He sat on it for a few. And then on his last day, as before he was actually sworn out and Monroe was sworn in, the day Monroe was sworn in, his last act as president of the United States, he signed his veto statement. He wrote the veto statement probably before that day, but he signed it the day he actually stepped out, the 17th of March, 1817. And he basically sent it back to the House to where it originated. And in that, he basically vetoed saying, look, you can't use the Necessary and Proper Clause. You can't use the Supremacy Clause. You can't use the General Defense and Welfare Clause, nor can you use the Commerce Clause to assume a new power like this. This is obviously not enumerated in the Constitution. So you have to amend the Constitution. And even if the states allow us to do this, allow you to actually improve highways and waterways, it doesn't make it constitutional. And everybody that does this will be in breach. And I'm actually adding a lot because, you know, the significance, because when we covered the bounties, the cod fishery bounties, he talked about how significant it would be when you started breaching, because once you've justified the spending of money to do something, then it just opens this floodgate. And he says, bottom line, you have to amend the Constitution for this to be illegitimate. So go get the amendment so that America can do this. And Congress basically took that as an insult. And that is why Congress basically stabbed Madison instead of, you know, actually doing what they meant to do, because they felt insulted. They, when they came to start creating, I think they wrote a note, "We hate Madison," somewhere. And they just pass around anything that has anything to do with Madison. You know, we're going to just tarnish this guy. So when they came out to start creating these memorials of the previous presidents, look at what they did for Thomas Jefferson, the guy that declared independence. Look at what they did for President Washington, the father of the nation. And look at what they did for the father of the Constitution. Nothing. Actually, go look it up for yourselves, folks. What is the memorial of James Madison? What did they create as a memorial for James Madison? They don't even have an Adams, John Adams memorial, right? They have a Jefferson memorial. They have a Lincoln memorial, who was much later. True. But what is the memorial for James Madison? Look it up, folks, and you'll realize what an insult that was. And that just speaks to how insulted Congress was when he did what he did. Okay, so putting that aside, 4 years later, actually, no, it was in 1822, so it was 5 years later, when James Monroe basically started serving, because it was in May, 1822, he was serving his final 4 years as president. And so when James Monroe, or no, actually he was well past that, because in 1820, he was halfway through his term. So because, right, the next president was elected in 1824, it was John Quincy Adams, who was only did one term. So in 1822, he was basically a lame duck president. It was basically anticipated he was only going to do this was his second and final term. And so they sent him a bill called the Cumberland Gap Bill. And it was very similar to the bill that they gave James Madison, where they were going to be able to improve some roadways. I don't even think they mentioned waterways, just roadways. And James Monroe looked at it, and he vetoed that bill. We have a very good video over this, folks. But the point is, is that the Constitution doesn't have these powers, these roles, responsibilities. And so James Monroe vetoed it and said, we can't do highways the way you're talking unless we amend the Constitution. Wow. So he vetoed it. They weren't very happy with him either. And he was another framer, founder, actually not a founder, founders of the states. He was a framer of the Constitution and a historical figure. Andrew Jackson, the next president, they already figured they weren't going to give it to John Quincy Adams. There's just no way another Republican. So this big government Democrat that actually, you know, assumed office in 1828, they said, okay, we'll give it to him. So in May of 1830, they went to him and said, hey, we want to give you this bill so that we can start improving some of our highway systems. And Andrew Jackson, in the longest veto statement over transportation, because Madison's was one page, Monroe's was like 2.5 pages, and then Jackson, his veto statement was 9 pages. And in his veto statement, he literally cited word for word verbatim, quote, Madison on what he said to Congress. And then,
really?
And then he quoted what Monroe said to Congress when they tried to do this. And then he basically says, if the good people of America, he wraps up with this, if the good people of America want us to be able to improve highways, waterways, and these types of things, go to the people and get them to amend their Constitution. And actually, all three presidents encouraged them. They said, I would help. Monroe basically says, this is such a good, worthy cause. I will help. Come meet with me. As a matter of fact, in the veto messages of Monroe and Jackson, they talk about meeting in the near future so that we can work together to get this amendment through. Why did Congress refuse to do it? Why were they so hell-bent on actually ignoring and assuming the power?
Yeah, why?
I believe this was the divine hand of providence that they had this attitude, that they felt that they had to be able to get to a point where they could assume powers. And so they kept on testing the water. And folks, the academic and empirical data proves that they could just assume powers. And this was one of the things that has never been taught in school. Why is it that you never learned about the 1817 veto statement of this attempt for the Department of Transportation, and the same thing in 1822 and the same thing in 1830? Why is it that you do not know about the three presidential vetoes of something so insignificant as the Department of Transportation? This is something that not one person bats an eye today as an unconstitutional power.
Yeah.
Nobody challenges it. There is not one patriotic group out there that says, we've got to stop this perversion of our government, the Department of Transportation. You know, they talk about education, they talk about health care, they talk about housing and labor, because those are very apparent. But nobody is saying, hey, this is equally unconstitutional as the rest of these. That's how important it was to assume the power, so that people would finally get to that point of going, well, you know, let them have the Department of Agriculture, let them have the Department of Interior, because, you know, they've already assumed doing these things, and they don't want to amend the Constitution. Well, let's just let them do it. And basically, we had three presidents that did their job in guarding us. So the real question goes down to, and I talked about this in my constitutional presidential series, does the president of the United States have the ability to not execute those laws that are unconstitutional? When he has his job, we covered it already in going through the Constitution. His job is to faithfully execute the laws of the Union. Well, those are not legitimate laws. So should he not execute those? Absolutely, he shouldn't. And he can actually point to. So we already talked about this as well in talking about the Constitution. Remember, I said that there needs to be a clause or an amendment to the Constitution that the president should be forbidden to be able to sign any law that is not in pursuance to the Constitution. It should be an impeachable offense. In other words, why is it that they didn't include the language that, of course, you cannot pass a law that is not in pursuant to the Constitution? Well, we're going to get into that when we cover Article 6. So the reality is, when we cover Article 6, we're going to actually dive into the Supremacy Clause. And I was hoping we could get into Article 6, but I didn't realize we were going to take this time with this story. But I think it's important. I think some of this stuff, I'm hoping I'm adding value to understanding this amendment process and how Congress just started assuming roles, responsibilities, and powers. So now that we've covered the two paths and the two processes, because they said it can be ratified by the state legislature or by conventions, but either way, it had to be ratified by 3/4 of the states. So we've covered the two paths and the two processes of amending and ratification to the Constitution. Now there's this one little part that nobody talks about. Nobody talks about this part. This is called, nobody even has a name for it. So obviously myself, Doug Gibbs, and a few others that we've talked about, Keith Broders is another one. But those people that are constitutional scholars and, you know, I'll just say pushing the edge or the envelope regarding the Constitution, there's very few of us that talk about this. And I've written an article, and I tell people this is how your state can actually start invoking changes that's going on in the Senate. So go ahead and read this last part. There's two parts of this. We'll read the first part, and then we'll read the second part.
Where it's provided?
Provided that no amendment, okay. Correct.
Provided that no amendment, which may be made prior to the year 1808, shall in any manner affect the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of the first article.
Okay, so that right there basically says that no amendment can be passed and ratified that would affect the ending of the slave trade. In other words, they made sure that that would not allow, an amendment would not allow the ending of the slave trade. This was the compromise. And in the Constitutional Convention, this was not actually carried through in Madison's notes, because this really upset Madison. And it was actually noted by somebody else in their journals or what have you, how Madison really was just fuming when they basically put this clause in here, because he wanted it to be hard-coded that clause was actually in there to actually be very plain language that we're going to end the slave trade in 1808. And so what he basically said was, hey, who's going to remember in 1808 that's when the slave trade is going to end? Who around us is going to be around to even, hey, this is in the Constitution. It's not very well, you know, identified that this must end. It needs to be bolder and it needs to be plainer. They added this into Article 5 that it could not be amended out to make sure that it would end. And here's the divine hand of providence. Who became president in 1808?
Lincoln?
James Madison.
Okay.
Now, see the irony here? How Madison basically jumped up and down in the Constitutional Convention going, who's going to remember that even exists in the Constitution? He made sure that the one person that needed to remember to end the slave trade was actually the president. That's irony for you, right? Isn't that just, wow. I mean, he wasn't predicting that he'd be president in 20 years.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. So that amendment was guarded that they could not take away the ending of the slave trade. And then the Second Amendment Protection Clause. So there are two types of amendments that cannot be created. The first one would end the slave trade. And the next one is what? And it's all in pink. Go ahead.
That no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate.
In other words, there cannot be an amendment that would actually take away the state legislature's suffrage in the Senate without the state legislature's consent. So when you read the 17th Amendment, does the 17th Amendment take away the state legislature's suffrage? No, it only changes it. In other words, when you read the 17th Amendment, the 17th Amendment does not dive into this suffrage that is protected in Article 5. if the 17th Amendment was actually to shift suffrage for the representation of the state legislature to shift to the people, they would actually have to, and it would require this part of the Constitution to equally be amended. So here's the thing. Had the 17th Amendment tried to touch Article 5, it would have pointed out that this right here doesn't allow that to happen. Not that easily. In other words, even though you may have three-fourths of the states that agree, it says that it requires 100% of the states. In other words, when the little states were guarding themselves, they said, we can never lose this without our own consent. So they basically made it so that if you rejected the 17th Amendment, and they actually included in the language the 17th Amendment to basically eradicate this, it would point out that they couldn't, that if you didn't vote for, then there's no way you can lose your suffrage or even be affected by that amendment. Technically, the seven states that never ratified the 17th Amendment should not even have to apply the changes by using a democratic appointment process where the people chose their senators like they do today. In other words, in Utah, Florida, Georgia, and the other states that never ratified the 17th Amendment, they should still actually, the state legislature should still actually be appointing them to that extent. But regardless of whether they're appointing them or not, and whether they change the appointment process, no state can lose their suffrage. So every state could actually, state legislature, let's be clear, when they say state here, they're talking about state legislature. No state legislature can lose their suffrage by their senators in the Senate. So this is why those eight states that I pointed out that are Republican-controlled, that Schumer is getting them to do their bidding by passing these unconstitutional laws and measures that they're putting through in the Senate and changing themselves. I'm telling you, those state legislatures could actually say, you better vote against that or we're pulling you back. Because you have to give us our suffrage in accordance with Article 5. It says no state without its consent shall be deprived. And if you deprive us of this specific suffrage, then we will pull you back and we'll undo what you're doing. It's that simple. Does that make sense? The wisdom and all of these things existing in the Constitution, of seeing how the Constitution is being perverted and subverted in so many different ways, you can't tell me that all of these things are just a coincidence.
Yeah.
Only he knew. I say this all the time. Only he had the providence of knowing what we would be dealing with today and making sure that we have what we need in this Constitution to shut up those who are attacking it. The problem is that we've become so illiterate regarding our Constitution that we don't even know how to defend it. We don't even know that it possesses the things necessary to defend it.
Yeah.
So, in other words, it's kind of our own fault, right? Now, that gives us the opportunity to dive into Article 6. We won't probably get through this, but let's go through this. So, Article 6 right here, the first part, all debts, contracted, engagements, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. All debts contracted and engagements entered into before the adoption of this Constitution shall be valid against the United States under this Constitution as under the Confederation.
Okay, so this is kind of a dead part of the Constitution because this only was a signal to all the foreign states in the world that if we had engagements, if we had any debt that was contracted, in these debts and engagements with these other states, these other sovereignties under the Articles of Confederation, that because territories, the United States territories, were not nations. They were territories. In other words, they were, let's call it, subjects of or already under the jurisdiction of Articles of Confederation, or I should say Continental Congress. Under, as everything shifted from Continental Congress to this new form of government, That all just shifted. But what they were doing right here was they were basically putting a banner up. Even though we have new management, everything that we've committed to you, will be acknowledged and respected and what's the better word for it? Acknowledged, respected, and basically invoked. In other words, we will enforce and validate all of these things we've already done with you. We're going to make sure we pay these debts. We're going to follow through with these engagements. So that, like I said, this is one part of the Constitution that could actually be deleted.
Yeah.
Now, this is where, you know, if we really look at a constitutional history, we need to have the original language. This is what they originally put in the Constitution. This is version one. If you ever do software versioning, you actually always maintain your original versionings, right? From one to one, you know, 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, you know, and going on and on. So when we actually start adding a new amendment, that becomes 1.7, you know, with the Seventh Amendment or all these different right. changes. So we have multiple versions. Every time we've made a change, we've changed the Constitution. And it's in its entirety, no. However that change was, it's still a change, and it becomes a dot. So my point is that there's reasons for getting rid of defects. Like when we did the second 13th Amendment, which was the ending of slavery. And I think the 15th Amendment was a part of that too, right? Or was the 15th Amendment... As I look at the 15th Amendment, the right of the citizens shall not be denied. So actually the servitude, I think, was the 13th Amendment. Yeah, neither slavery nor involuntary. So the 13th Amendment, which should have been the 14th, because we already have a 13th Amendment. We'll get into this moving forward. But this right here should have actually removed any part of the articles that identified slavery. In other words, they should have actually gone through and cleaned up Articles 1 and Articles 4 and so forth. Anything that had, you know, returning slaves or slave apportionments, all of that, it should have been actually, they should have scrubbed the Constitution for version 1.15. Because that's right. or 1.14 for this particular amendment. That's my point. So
that would be nice if they did that.
It would be, because then when we read it, we can't be confused with, you know, what is the real language? Right. So, okay.
We're reading 1.15.
Right. There you go. So now the next part, because this is the Supremacy Clause. And so the Supremacy Clause is the entire part that's read. Go ahead and read it. Then we're going to dissect the Supremacy Clause. So go ahead.
Okay. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land.
Okay, now I'm going to read it without the yellow text so that you can understand a huge difference between the Supremacy Clause with the yellow text and without it. This Constitution and the laws of the United States... Whoop, well, you know what? We just ran out of time. And so what we're going to do is we're going to pick back the Supremacy Clause. We'll start off again with the Supremacy Clause. And that way we can read this so you can hear the different ways and how important it is that they be in pursuance and under the authority. But we'll highlight that in our next show. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.